come home after leaving under suspicious, if not actually disgraceful, circumstances. The narrator, Sister, is outraged at having to cook two chickens to feed five people and a small child just because her spoiled sister has come home. What Sister can't see, but we can, is that those two fowl are really a fatted calf. It may not be a grand feast by traditional standards, but it is a feast, as called for upon the return of the prodigal son, even if the son turns out to be a daughter. Like the brothers in the parable, Sister is irritated and envious that the child who left and ostensibly used up her share of familial goodwill is instantly welcomed, her sins so quickly forgiven. Then there are all those names, those Jacobs and Jonahs and Rebekahs and Josephs and Marys and Stephens, and at least one Hagar. The naming of a character is a serious piece of business in a novel or play. A name has to sound right for a character. Oil Can Harry, Jay Gatsby, Beetle Bailey. But it also has to carry whatever message the writer wants to convey about the character or the story. In Song of Solomon, 1977, Toni Morrison's main family chooses names by allowing the family Bible to fall open, then pointing without looking at the text. Whatever proper noun the finger points to, there's the name. That's how you get a girl child in one generation named Pilate, and one in the next named First Corinthians. Morrison uses this naming practice to identify features of the family and the community. What else can you possibly use? The Atlas? Is there any city or hamlet or river in the world that tells us what we're told by Pilate? In this case, the insight is not into the character so named, for no one could be less like Pontius Pilate than the wise, generous, giving Pilate dead. Rather, her manner of naming tells us a great deal about the society that would lead a man, Pilate's father, to have absolute faith in the efficacy of a book he cannot read, so much so that he is guided by a principle of blind selection. Okay, so there are a lot of ways the Bible shows up. But isn't that a problem for anyone who isn't exactly a Bible scholar? Well, I'm not. But even I can sometimes recognize a biblical allusion. I use something I think of as the resonance test. If I hear something going on in a text that seems to be beyond the scope of the story's or poem's immediate dimensions, if it resonates outside itself, I start looking for allusions to older and bigger texts. Here's how it works. At the end of James Baldwin's story, Sonny's Blues, 1957, the narrator sends a drink up to the bandstand as a gesture of solidarity and acceptance to his brilliantly talented but wayward brother, Sonny, who takes a sip and, as he launches into the next song, sets the drink on the piano where it shimmers like the very cup of trembling. I lived for a good while not knowing where that phrase came from, although to the extent I thought about it, I was pretty sure. The story is so rich and full. The pain and redemption so compelling, the language so wonderful throughout. I didn't need to dwell on the last line for several readings. Still, there was something happening there, a kind of resonance, a sense that there's something meaningful beyond the simple meaning of the words. Peter Frampton says that E major is the great rock chord. All you have to do to set off pandemonium in a concert is to stand on stage alone and strike a big, fat, full E major. Everybody in the arena knows what that chord promises. That sensation happens in reading, too. When I feel that resonance, that fat chord that feels heavy yet sparkles with promise or portent, it almost always means the phrase, or whatever, is borrowed from somewhere else and promises special significance. More often than not, particularly if the borrowing feels different in tone and weight from the rest of the prose, that somewhere is the Bible. Then it's a matter of figuring out where and what it means. It helps that I know that Baldwin was a preacher's son, that his most famous novel is called Go Tell It on the Mountain, 1952, that the story already displays a strong Cain and Abel element when the narrator initially denies his responsibility towards Sonny, so my scriptural hunch was pretty strong. Happily, in the case of Sonny's Blues, the story is so heavily anthologized that it's almost impossible not to find the answer. The phrase comes from Isaiah 51:17. The passage speaks of the cup of the Lord's fury, and the context has to do with sons who have lost their way, who are afflicted, who may yet succumb to desolation and destruction. The ending of the story is therefore made even more provisional and uncertain by the quote from Isaiah. Sonny may make it, or he may not. He may relapse into addiction and trouble with the law. Beyond that, though, there is the broader sense of the residents of Harlem where the story is set, and by extension of Black America, as afflicted, as having drunk from that cup of trembling. There is hope in Baldwin's last paragraph, but it is hope tempered by knowledge of terrible dangers. Is my reading greatly enhanced by this knowledge? Perhaps not greatly. Something subtle happens there, but no thunder and lightning. The meaning doesn't move in the opposite direction or shift radically. If it did, that would be self-defeating, since so many readers would not get the allusion. I think it's more that the ending picks up a little greater weight from the association with Isaiah, a greater impact, pathos even. Oh, I think, it isn't just a 20th century problem, this business of brothers having trouble with each other and of young men stumbling and falling. It's been going on since forever. Most of the great tribulations to which human beings are subject are detailed in Scripture. No jazz, no heroin, no rehab centers maybe, but trouble very much of the kind Sonny has. The troubled spirit that lies behind the outward modern manifestations of heroin and prison. The weariness and resentment and guilt of the brother. His sense of failure at having broken the promise to his dying mother to protect Sonny. The Bible knows all about that too. This depth is what the biblical dimension adds to the story of Sonny and his brother. We no longer see merely the sad and sordid modern story of a jazz musician and his algebra teacher brother. Instead, the story resonates with a richness of distant antecedents, with a power of accumulated myth. The story ceases to be locked in the middle of the 20th century and becomes timeless and archetypal, speaking of the tensions and difficulties that exist always and everywhere between brothers, with all their caring and pain and guilt and pride and love. And that story never grows old. Chapter 8. Hansel D. and Gretel Dumm. By now I've beaten you severely about the head and shoulders with the notion that all literature grows out of other literature. We're dealing in this case, however, with a pretty loose category, which could include novels, stories, plays, poems, songs, operas, films, television, commercials, and possibly a variety of newer or not yet invented electronic media we haven't even seen. So let's try being a writer for a moment. You want to borrow from some source to add a bit of flesh to the bare bones of your story. Who are you going to call? Actually, Ghostbusters is not a bad answer, in the short run. Will people in 100 years, though, be conversant with film comedy of the 1980s? Maybe not, but they will get it right now. If you want topical resonance, current film or television may work fine, although the frame of reference as well as the staying power may be a little limited. But let's think in terms of slightly more canonical sources. The literary canon, by the way, is a master list of works that everyone pretends doesn't exist, the list, not the works, but that we all know matters in some important way. A great deal of argument goes into what, and more important, who is in the canon, which is to say, whose work gets studied in college courses. This being America, and not France, there is no academy that actually sets a list of canonical texts. The selection is more de facto. When I was in school, the canon was very white and male. Virginia Woolf, for example, was the only modern British woman writer who made the cut at a lot of schools. Nowadays, She'll likely be joined by Dorothy Richardson, Mina Loy, Stevie Smith, Edith Sitwell, or any number of others. The list of great writers or great works is fairly fluid. But back to the problem of literary borrowing. So among traditional works, from whom should you borrow? Homer? Half of the people who will read that name think of the guy who says, "Don't!" Have you read The Iliad lately? Do they read Homer in Homer, Michigan? Do they care about Troy in Troy, Ohio? In the 18th century, Homer was a sure bet, although you were more likely to read him in translation than in Greek. But not now. Not if you want most of your readers to get the reference. That's not a reason not to cite Homer, by the way, only a caution that not everyone will get the message. Shakespeare, then? After all, he's been the gold standard for allusion for 400 years and still is. On the other hand, there's the highbrow issue. He may turn off some readers who feel you're trying too hard. Plus, his quotes are like eligible persons of the other sex. All the good ones are taken. Maybe something from the 20th century. James Joyce? Definitely a problem. So much complexity. T.S. Eliot? He's all quotes from elsewhere to begin with. One of the problems with the diversification of the canon is that modern writers can't assume a common body of knowledge on the part of their readers. What readers know varies so much more than it once did. So what can the writer use for parallels, analogies, plot structures, references that most of his readers will know? Kitty Lit. Yep. Alice in Wonderland, Treasure Island, the Narnia novels, The Wind in the Willows and The Cat in the Hat, Good Night Moon. We may not know Shylock, but we all know Sam I Am. Fairy tales, too, although only the major ones. Slavic folk tales, those darlings of the Russian formalist critics of the 1920s, don't have a lot of currency in Paducah. But thanks to Disney, they know Snow White from Vladivostok to Valdosta, Sleeping Beauty from Sligo to Salinas. An added bonus here is the lack of ambiguity in fairy tales. While we may not know quite what to think about Hamlet's treatment of Ophelia or the fate of Laertes, we're pretty darn sure what we think about the evil stepmother or Rumpelstiltskin. We kind of like the idea of Prince Charming or the healing power of tears. Of all the fairy tales available to the writer, there's one that has more drawing power than any other, at least in the late 20th century, Hansel and Gretel. Every age has its own favorite stories, but the story of children lost and far from home has a universal appeal. For the age of anxiety, the age when blind faith sang, "Can't find my way home," the age of not just lost boys, but lost generations, H&G has to be the preferred story. And it is. The tale shows up in a variety of ways in a host of stories from the 60s on. Robert Coover has a story called The Gingerbread House, 1969, whose innovation is that the two children aren't called Hansel and Gretel. The story makes use of our knowledge of the original story by employing signs we'll recognize as standing in for the parts we're familiar with. Since we already know the story from the arrival at the gingerbread house till the shove into the oven, Coover doesn't mention it. The witch, for example, as the story progresses, is metonymically transformed into the black rag she wears, as if we're just catching her out of the corner of our eye. Metonymy is the rhetorical device in which a part is made to stand for the whole, as when Washington is used to represent America's position on an issue. We don't see her attack the children directly. Rather, she kills the doves that eat the breadcrumbs. In some ways, this act is even more menacing. It's as if she is erasing the only memory of the children's way home. When, at the end of the tale, the boy and girl arrive at the gingerbread house, we only get a glimpse of the black rags flapping in the breeze. We're made to reevaluate what we know of this story, of the degree to which we take its elements for granted. By stopping the story where the drama normally kicks in, with the children innocently transgressing against the witch's property, Coover forces us to see how our responses, anxiety, trepidation, excitement, are conditioned by our previous encounters with the original fairy tale. See, he suggests, you don't need the story because you have already internalized it so completely. That's one thing writers can do with readerly knowledge of source texts. In this case, fairy tales. They can mess around with the stories and turn them upside down. Angela Carter does that in The Bloody Chamber, 1979, a collection of stories that tear the roof off old sexist fairy tales to create subversive feminist revisions. She upends our expectations about the story of Bluebeard, or Puss in Boots, or Little Red Riding Hood, to make us see the sexism inherent in those stories and, by extension, in the culture that embraced them. But that's not the only way to use old stories. Coover and Carter put the emphasis on the old story itself, while most writers are going to dredge up pieces of the old tale to shore up aspects of their own narratives, without placing the focus on Hansel and Gretel or Rapunzel. Okay, let's assume you're the writer. You have a young couple, maybe not children, and certainly not the children of the woodsman, and definitely not brother and sister. Let's say you have a pair of young lovers, and for whatever reason they're lost. Maybe their car broke down far from home. Maybe there's no forest, but a city, all public housing high-rises. They've taken a wrong turn, suburban types with a BMW maybe, and they're in a part of town that is wilderness as far as they're concerned. So they're lost, no cell phone, and maybe the only option turns out to be a crack house. What you've got in this hypothetical tale is a fairly dramatic setup that's already fraught with possibility. All perfectly modern, no woodcutter, no breadcrumbs, no gingerbread. So why dredge up some moldy old fairy tale? What can it possibly tell us about this modern situation? Well, what elements do you want to emphasize in your story? What feature of the plight of these young people most resonates for you? It might be the sense of lostness. Children too far from home, in a crisis, not of their own making. Maybe the temptation. One child's gingerbread is another's drugs. Maybe it's having to fend for themselves without their customary support network. Depending on what you want to accomplish, you may choose some prior tale. In our case, H and G. And emphasize what you see as corresponding elements in the two tales. It may be pretty simple, like the guy wishing they had a trail of breadcrumbs because he missed a turn or two back there and doesn't know this part of town. Or the woman hoping this doesn't turn out to be the witch's house. Here's the good deal for you as writer. You don't have to use the whole story. Sure, it has X, Y, and B, but not A, C, and Z. So what? We're not trying to recreate the fairy tale here. Rather, we're trying to make use of details or patterns, portions of some prior story, or once you really start thinking like a professor, prior text, since everything is a text, to add depth and texture to your story, to bring out a theme, to lend irony to a statement, to play with readers' deeply ingrained knowledge of fairy tales. So use as much or as little as you want. In fact, you may invoke the whole story simply by a single small reference. Why? Because fairy tales, like Shakespeare, the Bible, mythology, and all other writing and telling, belong to the one big story. And because, since we were old enough to be read to or propped up in front of a television, we've been living on that story and on its fairy variants. Once you've seen Bugs Bunny or Daffy Duck in a version of one of the classics, you pretty much own it as part of your consciousness. In fact, it will be hard to read the Grimm Brothers and not think Warner Brothers. Doesn't that work out to be sort of ironic? Absolutely. That's one of the best side effects of borrowing from any prior text. Irony, in various guises, drives a great deal of fiction and poetry, even when the work isn't overtly ironic or when the irony is subtle. Let's face it. These two clandestine lovers are hardly babes in the woods, but maybe they are. Socially out of their depth in this part of town. Morally misguided, perhaps. Lost and in danger. Ironically, their symbols of power, BMW, Rolex watch, money, expensive clothes, don't help them a bit and actually make them more vulnerable. Finding their way and avoiding the witch may be as hard for them as for the two pint-sized venturers of the original, so they don't have to push anyone into an oven. or leave a trail of crumbs or break off and eat any of the siding. And they are probably far from innocent. Whenever fairy tales and their simplistic worldview crop up in connection with our complicated and morally ambiguous world, you can almost certainly plan on irony. In the age of existentialism and thereafter, the story of lost children has been all the rage. Coover, Carter, John Barth, Tim O'Brien, Louise Erdrich, Toni Morrison, Thomas Pynchon, on and on and on. But you don't have to use Hansel and Gretel just because it's the flavor of the month, or even of the last half century. Cinderella will always have her uses. Snow White works. Anything, in fact, with an evil queen or stepmother. Rapunzel has her applications. Even the Jay Giles Band mentions her. Something with a Prince Charming? Okay, but tough to live up to the comparisons, so be prepared for irony. I've been talking here as if you're the writer. But you know, and I know, that we're really readers. So how does this apply? For one thing, it has to do with how you attack a text. When you sit down to read a novel, you want character, story, ideas, the usual business. Then if you're like me, you'll start looking for glimpses of the familiar. Hey, that kind of feels like something I know. Oh wait, that's out of Alice in Wonderland. Now why would she draw a parallel to the Red Queen here? Is that the hole in the ground? Why? Always, why? Here's what I think we do. We want strangeness in our stories, but we want familiarity, too. We want a new novel to be not quite like anything we've read before. At the same time, we look for it to be sufficiently like other things we've read so that we can use those to make sense of it. If it manages both things at once, strangeness and familiarity, it sets up vibrations, harmonies, to go with the melody of the main storyline. And those harmonies are where a sense of depth, solidity, resonance comes from. Those harmonies may come from the Bible, from Shakespeare, from Dante or Milton, but also from humbler, more familiar texts. So next time you go to your local bookstore and carry home a novel, don't forget your Brothers Grimm. Chapter 9. It's Greek to me. In these last three chapters, we've talked about three sorts of myth: Shakespearean, biblical, and folk/fairy tale. The connection of religion and myth sometimes causes trouble in class when someone takes myth to mean untrue and finds it hard to unite that meaning with deeply held religious beliefs. That's not what I mean by myth, though. Rather, what I'm suggesting is the shaping and sustaining power of story and symbol. Whether one believes that the story of Adam and Eve is true, literally or figuratively, matters, but not in this context. Here, in this activity of reading and understanding literature, we're chiefly concerned with how that story functions as material for literary creators, the way in which it can inform a story or poem, and how it is perceived by the reader. All three of these mythologies work as sources of material, of correspondences, of depth for the modern writer. And every writer is modern. Even John Dryden was not archaic when he was writing. And provided they're recognizable to the reader, they enrich and enhance the reading experience. Of the three, biblical myth probably covers the greatest range of human situations, encompassing all ages of life, including the next life. All relationships, whether personal or governmental, and all phases of the individual's experience, physical, sexual, psychological, spiritual. Still, both the worlds of Shakespeare and of fairy and folk tales provide fairly complete coverage as well. What we mean in speaking of myth in general is story, the ability of story to explain ourselves to ourselves. In ways that physics, philosophy, mathematics, chemistry, all very highly useful and informative in their own right, can't. That explanation takes the shape of stories that are deeply ingrained in our group memory, that shape our culture and are in turn shaped by it, that constitute a way of seeing by which we read the world and, ultimately, ourselves. Let's say it this way. Myth is a body of story that matters. Every community has its own body of story that matters. 19th century composer Richard Wagner went back to the Germanic myths for the material for his operas, and whether the results are good or bad in either historic or musical terms, the impulse to work with his tribal myths is completely understandable. The late 20th century witnessed a great surge of Native American writing, much of which went back to tribal myth for material, for imagery, for theme, as in the case of Leslie Marmon Silko's Yellow Woman, Louise Erdrich's Cashpaw Nanapush novels, and Gerald Visner's peculiar Bearheart, The Airship Chronicles. When Toni Morrison introduces human flight into Song of Solomon, many readers, white readers especially, take her to be referring to Icarus, whereas what she really has in mind, she has said, is the myth of the flying Africans, a story that matters to her community, her tribe. On one level, there's not much difference between Silko's project and Wagner's. He, too, is simply going back to the myths of his tribe. We sometimes forget that people in an age of top hats and stiff collars had tribes, but we do so at our peril. In all these cases, what the artist is doing is reaching back for stories that matter to him and his community, for myth. In European and Euro-American cultures, of course, there's another source of myth. Let me rephrase that. Myth. When most of us think myth, we mean the northern shores of the Mediterranean between 2,000 and 3,000 years ago. We mean Greece and Rome. Greek and Roman myth is so much a part of the fabric of our consciousness, of our unconscious, really, that we scarcely notice. You doubt me? In the town where I live, the college teams are known as the Spartans. Our high school, the Trojans. In my state, we have a Troy, one of whose high schools is Athens, and they say there were no comedians in education, an Ithaca, a Sparta, a Romulus, a Remus, and a Rome. These communities are scattered around the state and date from different periods of settlement. Now, if a town in the center of Michigan, a fair distance from anything that can be called Aegean or Ionian, although it's not very far from the town of Ionia, can be named Ithaca, it suggests that Greek myth has had pretty good staying power. Let's go back to Toni Morrison for a moment. I'm always slightly amazed that Icarus gets all the ink. It was his father, Daedalus, who crafted the wings, who knew how to get off Crete and safely reach the mainland, and who, in fact, flew to safety. Icarus, the kid, the daredevil, failed to follow his father's advice and plunged to his death. His fall remains a source of enduring fascination for us and for our literature and art. In it, we see so much. The parental attempt to save the child and the grief at having failed. The cure that proves as deadly as the ailment. The youthful exuberance that leads to self-destruction. The clash between sober adult wisdom and adolescent recklessness and, of course, the terror involved in that headlong descent into the sea. Absolutely none of this has anything to do with Morrison and her flying Africans, so it's little wonder that she's a bit mystified by this response of her readers. But it's a story and a pattern that is so deeply burrowed into our consciousness that readers may almost automatically consider it whenever flying or falling is invoked. Clearly, it doesn't fit the situation in Song of Solomon. But it does apply in other works. In 1558, Peter Bruegel painted a wonderful picture, Landscape with Fall of Icarus. In the foreground, we see a plowman and his ox. Just beyond him, a shepherd and his flock. And at sea, a merchant ship sailing placidly along. This is a scene of utter ordinariness and tranquility. Only in the lower right corner of the painting is there anything even remotely suggestive of trouble, a pair of legs askew as they disappear into the water. That's our boy. He really doesn't have much of a presence in the frame, but his presence makes all the difference. Without the pathos of the doomed boy, we have a picture of farming and merchant shipping with no narrative or thematic power. I teach with some regularity two great poems based on that painting, W. H. Auden's Musée des Beaux-Arts, 1940, and William Carlos Williams' Landscape with Fall of Icarus, 1962. They're wonderful poems, very different from each other in tone, style, and form, but in essential agreement about how the world goes on even in the face of our private tragedies. Each artist alters what he finds in the painting. Bruegel introduces the plowman and the ship, neither of which appears in the version that comes to us from the Greeks, and Williams and Auden find, in their turn, slightly different elements to emphasize in the painting. Williams' poem stresses the pictorial elements of the painting, trying to capture the scene while sneaking in the thematic elements. Even his arrangement of the poem on the page, narrow and highly vertical, recalls the body plummeting from the sky. Auden's poem, on the other hand, is a meditation on the private nature of suffering and the way in which the larger world takes no interest in our private disasters. It is astonishing and pleasing to discover that the painting can occasion these two very different responses. Beyond them, readers find their own messages in all this. As someone who was a teenager in the 60s, I am reminded by the fate of Icarus of all those kids who bought muscle cars with names like GTO and 442 and Charger and Barracuda. All the driver education and solid parental advice in the world can't overcome the allure of that kind of power. And sadly, in too many cases, those young drivers shared the fate of Icarus. My students, somewhat younger than I am, will inevitably draw other parallels. Still, it all goes back to the myth. The boy, the wings, the unscheduled dive. So that's one way classical myth can work. Overt subject matter for poems and paintings and operas and novels. What else can myth do? Here's a thought. Let's say you wanted to write an epic poem about a community of poor fishermen in the Caribbean. If this was a place you came from, and you knew these people like you know your own family, you'd want to depict the jealousies and resentments and adventure and danger, as well as capturing their dignity and their life in a way that conveys all that has escaped the notice of tourists and white property owners. You could, I suppose, try being really, really earnest, portraying the characters as very serious and sober, making them noble by virtue of their goodness. But I bet that wouldn't work. What you'd wind up with instead would probably be very stiff and artificial, and artificiality is never noble. Besides, these folks aren't saints. They make a lot of mistakes. They're petty, envious, lustful, occasionally greedy, as well as courageous, elegant, powerful, knowledgeable, profound. And you want noble, after all. Not Tonto. There's no Lone Ranger here. Alternatively, you might try grafting their story onto some older story of rivalry and violence, a story where even the victor is ultimately doomed, a story where, despite occasional personal shortcomings, the characters have an unmistakable nobility. You could give your characters names like Helen, Philoctetes, Hector, and Achilles. At least, that's what Nobel Prize winner Derek Walcott does in his Omeros, 1990. Those names are drawn, of course, from the Iliad, although Walcott uses elements, parallels, persons, and situations of both it and the Odyssey in his epic. The question we will inevitably ask is, why? Why should someone in the late 20th century draw on a story that was passed along orally from the 12th through the 8th century BC and not written down until maybe 200 or 300 years later? Why should someone try to compare modern fishermen with these legendary heroes, many of whom were descended from gods? Well, for starters, Homer's legendary heroes were farmers and fishermen. Besides, aren't we all descended from gods? Walcott reminds us by this parallel of the potential for greatness that resides in all of us, no matter how humble our worldly circumstances. That's one answer. The other is that the situations match up more closely than we might expect. The plot of the Iliad is not particularly divine or global. Those who have never read it assume mistakenly that it is the story of the Trojan War. It is not. It is the story of a single, rather lengthy action, the wrath of Achilles. Achilles becomes angry with his leader, Agamemnon, withdraws his support from the Greeks, only rejoining the battle when the consequences of his action have destroyed his best friend, Patroclus. At this point, he turns his wrath against the Trojans, and in particular their greatest hero, Hector, whom he eventually kills. His reason for such anger? Agamemnon has taken his war prize. Trivial? It gets worse. The prize is a woman. Agamemnon, forced by divine order and by public sentiment to return his concubine to her father, retaliates against the person who most publicly sided against him, Achilles, by taking his concubine, Briseis. Is that petty enough? Is that noble? No Helen, no judgment of Paris, no Trojan horse. At its core, it's the story of a man who goes berserk because his stolen war bride is confiscated, acted out against a background of wholesale slaughter, the whole of which is taking place because another man, Menelaus, brother of Agamemnon, has had his wife stolen by Paris, half-brother of Hector. That's how Hector winds up having to carry the hopes for salvation of all Troy on his shoulders. And yet somehow, through the centuries, this story dominated by the theft of two women has come to epitomize ideals of heroism and loyalty, sacrifice and loss. Hector is more stubbornly heroic in his doomed enterprise than anyone you've ever seen. Achilles' grief at the loss of his beloved friend is truly heartbreaking. The big duels, between Hector and Ajax, between Diomedes and Paris, between Hector and Patroclus, between Hector and Achilles, are genuinely exciting and suspenseful. Their outcomes, sources of grand celebration and dismay. No wonder so many modern writers have often borrowed from and emulated Homer. And when did that begin? Almost immediately. Virgil, who died in 19 BC, patterned his Aeneas on the Homeric heroes. If Achilles did it, or Odysseus went there, so does Aeneas. Why? It's what heroes do. Aeneas goes to the underworld. Why? Odysseus went there. He kills a giant from the enemy camp in a final climactic battle. Why? Achilles did. And so on. The whole thing is less derivative than it sounds, and not without humor and irony. Aeneas and his followers are survivors of Troy. So here we have this Trojan hero acting out the pattern set down by his enemies. Moreover, when these Trojans sail past Ithaca, home to Odysseus, they jeer and curse the agent of their destruction. On the whole, though, Virgil has him undertake these actions because Homer had already defined what it means to be a hero. Back to Walcott. Almost exactly 2,000 years after Virgil, Walcott has his heroes perform actions that we can recognize as symbolic reenactments of those in Homer. Sometimes it's a bit of a stretch, since we can't have a lot of battlefield duels out in the fishing boats. Nor can we call his Helen the face that launched 1,000 dinghies. Lacks grandeur, that phrase. What he can do, though, is place them in situations where their nobility and their courage are put to the test, while reminding us that they are acting out some of the most basic, most primal patterns known to humans, exactly as Homer did all those centuries before. The need to protect one's family, Hector. The need to maintain one's dignity, Achilles. The determination to remain faithful and to have faith, Penelope. The struggle to return home, Odysseus. Homer gives us four great struggles of the human being, with nature, with the divine, with other humans, and with ourselves. What is there, after all, against which we need to prove ourselves but those four things? In our modern world, of course, parallels may be ironized, that is, turned on their head for purposes of irony. How many of us would see the comedy of three escaped convicts as parallel to the wanderings of Odysseus? Still, that's what the brothers Joel and Ethan Coen give us in their 2000 film, O Brother, Where Art Thou? It's about trying to get home, isn't it? Or this, the most famous example. A single day in Dublin in 1904, on which a young man decides on his future and an older man wanders the city, eventually returning home to his wife in the small hours of the next morning. The book has only one overt clue that this all might have something to do with Homer. Its one-word title, Ulysses, 1922. As we now know, James Joyce envisioned every one of the 18 episodes of the novel as a parallel to some incident or situation in the Odyssey. There's an episode in a newspaper office, for instance, which parallels Odysseus's visit to Aeolus, the god of the winds, but the parallel may seem pretty tenuous. To be sure, newspaper men are a windy group, and there are a lot of rhetorical flourishes in the episode, to say nothing of the fact that a gust of wind does zip through at one point. Still, we can see it as resembling the Homeric original, only if we understand that resemblance in terms of a funhouse mirror, full of distortion and goofy correspondences. If we understand it, in other words, as an ironic parallel. The fact that it's ironic makes the parallel, and the Aeolus episode, such fun. Joyce is less interested than Walcott in investing his characters with classical nobility, although finally they do take on something of that quality. After watching poor old Leopold Bloom stroll around Dublin all day and half the night, running into no end of trouble and recalling great heartbreak in his life, we may well come to feel he is noble in his own way. His nobility, however, is not that of Odysseus. Greek and Roman myth, of course, is more than Homer. The transformations of Ovid's Metamorphoses show up in all sorts of later works, not least in Franz Kafka's story of a man who wakes up one morning to find he's changed into an enormous beetle. He called it the Metamorphosis. Indiana Jones may look like pure Hollywood, but the intrepid searcher after fabulous treasure goes back to Apollonius and the Argonautica, the story of Jason and the Argonauts. Something a bit homier? Sophocles' plays of Oedipus and his doomed clan show up over and over again in all sorts of variations. There is, in fact, no form of dysfunctional family or no personal disintegration of character for which there is not a Greek or Roman model. Not for nothing do the names of Greek tragic characters figure in Freud's theories. The wronged woman gone violent in her grief and madness? Would you like Aeneas and Dido, or Jason and Medea? And as in every good early religion, they had an explanation for natural phenomena, from the change of seasons, Demeter and Persephone and Hades, to why the nightingale sounds the way it does, Philomena and Tereus. Happily for us, most of it got written down, often in several versions, so that we have access to this wonderful body of story. And because writers and readers share knowledge of a big portion of this body of story, this mythology, when writers use it, we readers recognize it, sometimes to its full extent, sometimes only dimly or only because we know the Looney Tunes version. That recognition makes our experience of literature richer, deeper, more meaningful, so that our own modern stories also matter, also share in the power of myth. Oh, did I forget to say that title of Walcott's Omeros? In the local dialect, it means Homer. Naturally. Chapter 10. It's More Than Just Rain or Snow. It was a dark and stormy night. What, you've heard that one? Right. Snoopy. And Charles Schulz had Snoopy write it because it was a cliché, and had been one for a very long time, way back when your favorite beagle decided to become a writer. This one we know. Edward Bulwer Lytton, celebrated Victorian popular novelist, actually did write It Was a Dark and Stormy Night. In fact, he began a novel with it, and not a very good novel either. And now you know everything you need to know about dark and stormy nights, except for one thing. Why? You wondered that too, didn't you? Why would a writer want the wind howling and the rain bucketing down? Want the manor house or the cottage or the weary traveler lashed and battered? You may say that every story needs a setting and that weather is part of the setting. That is true, by the way, but it isn't the whole deal. There's much more to it. Here's what I think. Weather is never just weather. It's never just rain. And that goes for snow, sun, warmth, cold, and probably sleet, although the incidence of sleet in my reading is too rare to generalize. So what's special about rain? Ever since we crawled up on the land, the water, it seems to us, has been trying to reclaim us. Periodically, floods come and try to drag us back into the water, pulling down our improvements while they're at it. You know the story of Noah. Lots of rain, major flood, ark, cubits, dove, olive branch, rainbow. I think that biblical tale must have been the most comforting of all to ancient humans. The rainbow, by which God told Noah that no matter how angry he got, he would never try to wipe us out completely, must have come as a great relief. We in the Judeo-Christian Islamic world have a fair chunk of mythology invested in rain and its most major byproduct. Clearly, rain features in other mythologies as well, but for now, let this be our cornerstone. Drowning is one of our deepest fears, being land creatures after all, and the drowning of everything and everybody just magnifies that fear. Rain prompts ancestral memories of the most profound sort. So water in great volume speaks to us at a very basic level of our being. And at times, Noah is what it signifies. Certainly when D.H. Lawrence has the flood go crashing through the family homestead in The Virgin and the Gypsy, 1930, he's thinking of Noah's flood, the big eraser that destroys but also allows a brand new start. Rain, though, can do a lot more. That dark and stormy evening, and I suspect that before general illumination by streetlight and neon, all stormy evenings were pretty darn dark, has worlds of atmosphere and mood. Thomas Hardy, a considerably better Victorian writer than Edward B.L., has a delightful story called The Three Strangers, 1883, in which a condemned man, escaped, a hangman, and the escapee's brother all converge on a shepherd's house during a christening party. The hangman doesn't recognize his quarry, nor do the members of the party, but the brother does and runs away, leading to a manhunt and general hilarity, all of which is taking place on a, well, dark and stormy night. Hardy doesn't call it that, but he has great fun describing in his ironic and detached tone the rain lashing down on hapless wayfarers, forcing them to seek shelter where they can. Hence the appearance of our three gentlemen callers. Now the Bible is never very far from Hardy's thoughts, but I dare say he has no idea of Noah when he's writing about this storm. So why does he bring rain into it? First of all, as a plot device. The rain forces these men together in very uncomfortable, for the condemned man and the brother, circumstances. I occasionally disparage plot, but we should never discount its importance in authorial decision-making. Second, atmospherics. Rain can be more mysterious, murkier, more isolating than most other weather conditions. Fog is good too, of course. Then there is the misery factor. Given the choice between alternatives, Hardy will always go for making his characters more miserable, and rain has a higher wretchedness quotient than almost any other element of our environment. With a little rain and a bit of wind, you can die of hypothermia on the 4th of July. Needless to say, Hardy loves rain. And finally, there is the democratic element. Rain falls on the just and the unjust alike. Condemned man and hangman are thrown into a bond of sorts because rain has forced each of them to seek shelter. Rain can do other things as well, but these are the reasons, it seems to me, that Hardy has chosen a nice, malicious rainstorm for his story. What other things? For one, it's clean. One of the paradoxes of rain is how clean it is coming down and how much mud it can make when it lands. So if you want a character to be cleansed, symbolically, let him walk through the rain to get somewhere. He can be quite transformed when he gets there. He may also have a cold, but that's another matter. He can be less angry, less confused, more repentant, whatever you want. The stain that was upon him, figuratively, can be removed. On the other hand, if he falls down, He'll be covered in mud and therefore more stained than before. You can have it either way or both ways if you're really good. The problem with cleansing, though, is the problem with wishes. You have to be careful what you wish for, or, for that matter, what you want cleansed. Sometimes it backfires. In Song of Solomon, Toni Morrison gives her poor, jilted lover, Hagar, an encounter with cleansing rain. Having been thrown over by her longtime lover and cousin, it's very awkward, Milkman, for a more presentable love interest, with looks and especially hair nearer the white ideal, Hagar spends a desperate day buying clothes and accessories, visiting hair and nail salons, and generally turning herself into a simulacrum of the woman she thinks Milkman wants. After spending all her money and psychic energy in this mad plunge into a fantasy image, she is caught out in a rainstorm that ruins her clothes, her packages, and her coiffure. She is left with her despised, kinky, black hair and her self-loathing. Rather than washing away some taint, the rain cleanses her of illusions and the false ideal of beauty. The experience, of course, destroys her, and she soon dies of a broken heart and rain. So much for the salutary effects of cleansing rains. On the other hand, rain is also restorative. This is chiefly because of its association with spring, but Noah once again comes into play here. Rain can bring the world back to life, to new growth, to the return of the green world. Of course, novelists being what they are, they generally use this function ironically. In the ending of A Farewell to Arms, 1929, Hemingway, having killed off Frederick Henry's lover during childbirth, sends the grieving protagonist out of the hospital into, you guessed it, rain. It might be ironic enough to die during childbirth, which is also associated with spring, but the rain, which we might properly expect to be life-giving, further heightens the irony. It's hard to get irony too high for Hemingway. So too with Joyce's The Dead. Near the ending, Greta Conroy tells her husband about the great love of her life, the long-dead Michael Fury, a consumptive boy who stood outside her window in the rain and died a week later. One might argue that this is simply verisimilitude. If the story is set in the west of Ireland, it almost requires rain. No doubt there is justice in this view. But at the same time, Joyce knowingly plays off our expectations of rain as an agent of new life and restoration because he also knows that we have another, less literary set of associations for rain, the source of chills, colds, pneumonia, death. These come together and clash intriguingly in the image of the boy dying for love. Youth, death, replenishment, desolation, they're all rattling around in the figure of poor Michael Fury in the rain. Joyce likes his irony about as high as Hemingway's. Rain is the principal element of spring. April showers do, in fact, bring May flowers. Spring is the season, not only of renewal, but of hope, of new awakenings. Now, if you're a modernist poet, and therefore given to irony. Notice that I've not yet alluded to modernism without having recourse to irony. You might stand that association on its head and begin your poem with a line like, April is the cruelest month, which is exactly what T.S. Eliot does in The Wasteland. In that poem, he plays off our cultural expectations of spring and rain and fertility. Better, readers don't even have to ask if he is doing it deliberately, since he very thoughtfully provides notes telling us that he's being deliberate. He even tells us which study of romance he's using, Jesse L. Weston's From Ritual to Romance, 1920. What Weston talks about in her book is the Fisher King mythology, of which the Arthurian legends are just one part. The central figure in this set of myths, the Fisher King figure, represents the hero as fixer. Something in society is broken, perhaps beyond repair, but a hero emerges to put things right. Since natural and agricultural fertility is so important to our ability to feed and sustain ourselves, Much of the material Weston deals with has to do with wastelands and the attempts to restore lost fertility. Needless to say, rain figures prominently. Following Weston's lead, Eliot emphasizes the absence of rain from the beginning of his poem. On the other hand, water generally is a mixed medium in his text, the River Thames being polluted and a scene of corruption, complete with a slimy bellied rat on the bank. Moreover, the rain never quite arrives. We're told at the end that rain is coming, but that's not the same as rain actually hitting the ground around us. So then, it isn't quite happening, and we can't be sure of its effect when it does fall, if it does, but its absence occupies a major space in the poem. Rain mixes with sun to create rainbows. We mentioned this one before, but it merits our consideration. While we may have minor associations with pots of gold and leprechauns, the main function of the image of the rainbow is to symbolize divine promise, peace between heaven and earth. God promised Noah with the rainbow never again to flood the whole earth. No writer in the West can employ a rainbow without being aware of its signifying aspect, its biblical function. Lawrence called one of his best novels The Rainbow, 1916. It has, as you would guess, a certain amount of flood imagery, along with all the associations that imagery conveys. When you read about a rainbow, as in Elizabeth Bishop's poem The Fish, 1947, where she closes with the sudden vision that everything was rainbow, 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 you just know there's some element of this divine pact between human, nature, and God. Of course, she lets the fish go. In fact, of any interpretation a reader will ever come up with, the rainbow probably forms the most obvious set of connections. Rainbows are sufficiently uncommon and gaudy that they're pretty hard to miss, and their meaning runs as deep in our culture as anything you care to name. Once you can figure out rainbows, you can do rain and all the rest. Fog, for instance. It almost always signals some sort of confusion. Dickens uses a miasma, a literal and figurative fog, for the Court of Chancery, the English version of American probate court, where estates are sorted out and wills contested, in Bleak House, 1853. Henry Green uses a heavy fog to gridlock London and strand his wealthy young travelers in a hotel in Party Going, 1939. In each case, the fog is mental and ethical as well as physical. In almost any case I can think of, authors use fog to suggest that people can't see clearly, that matters under consideration are murky. And snow? It can mean as much as rain. Different things, though. Snow is clean, stark, severe, warm as an insulating blanket, paradoxically, inhospitable, inviting, playful, suffocating, filthy, after enough time has elapsed. You can do just about anything you want with snow. In The Peterson Kid, 1968, William H. Gass has death arrive on the heels of a monster blizzard. In his poem The Snowman, 1923, Wallace Stevens uses snow to indicate inhuman abstract thought, particularly thought concerned with nothingness, nothing that is not there and the nothing that is, as he puts it. Very chilling image, that. And in The Dead, Joyce takes his hero to a moment of discovery. Gabriel, who sees himself as superior to other people, has undergone an evening in which he is broken down, little by little, until he can look out at the snow, which is general all over Ireland, and suddenly realize that snow, like death, is the great unifier, that it falls in the beautiful closing image upon all the living and the dead. This will all come up again when we talk about seasons. There are many more possibilities for weather, of course, more than we could cover in a whole book. For now, though, one does well to remember, as one starts reading a poem or story, to check the weather. Interlude. Does he mean that? Along about now, you should be asking a question, something like this. You keep saying that the writer is alluding to this obscure work and using that symbol or following some pattern or other that I never heard of, but does he really intend to do that? Can anyone really have all that going on in his head at one time? Now that is an excellent question. I only wish I had an excellent answer. Something